welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man that just got done making some blood soap for the Forged Supply Company. It's Jack Austin.
How's everybody doing? Yeah, the soap is really disgusting, but it was a labor of love.
Oh, man, would you? It just seems very... It didn't putrefy, coagulate? Like, how'd you do this?
Coagulation is actually a big part of the whole process.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It feels really good. Not like your typical hard soap. It feels like you're just wiping a soapy bag on your body. We don't even need to get into the FDA or any other health regulations. Just trust me and use it.
Hearing someone say wipe a bag of blood on my body, that's one of the... That shook me to my core. And I got to tell you, so I joined Jack on his show, the Alter Ego podcast, the wonderful show, several times where we've gotten really weird. And we were talking about a very pungent soap that is Cyborg Mark, made. And it is still sinking to the core of the earth, that soap that I bought from him. So that speaks for how excellent this soap is, Jack.
For sure. Yeah, it's still sinking right now. Next one we throw through, we're going to put a tracker on it so we can kind of keep live and monitor its trek through the Earth's core.
Sometimes I just like to listen to it destroy the Earth's crust. I can still hear bubbling down there.
Put your ear by the cavity in the Earth and listen to the ever-present sizzle of the soap going through the Earth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for finally joining my show. I mean, I've been on your show a couple times, and we've made it super weird. I mean, we had an episode where we compared Shark in Venice, not Sharks in Venice, with the 1990s Fantastic Four film. Oof. And, I mean, those are two movies that deserve comparison.
They do.
Yeah. I think the world needed it.
It's possible, but we did it.
And now you're here to join me to talk about Blade, which... Yes. Makes me very, very, very happy. I mean, the 1998 release film starring Wesley Snipes, directed by Stephen Norrington and written by David S. Goyer, who's actually a big name nowadays. I mean, he's worked on Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. He's Man of Steel. The guy has been prolific in his writing. And for me, I was 16 years old when Blade came out. And I remember driving to the theater, getting my ticket. The guy was really cool there. I was 16. He still sold me a ticket for a 17-year-old film. I walked in and, you know, you get the opening scene in the hospital, but then you go to this blood rave where you have this guy, this sort of, I don't know, Tracy Lord's driving this dude to a meatpacking factory. Once he gets inside, a blood rave happens. And this guy who would normally be, you know, the tough guy, right? This kind of alpha male. He becomes this cowering mess in front of these vampires that are just messing with him and looking horrifying. And everything changes when these horrifying alpha predators see Blade. And then they just become like the guy who just saw the vampires. They see Blade and they become him. And they all put their Kangol hats on and they run around. They're slipping because blood's everywhere. And it was such an excellent intro to a film. Without many words, we know right off the bat, even if we didn't know the comic, we know that vampires are afraid of Blade. Yes. And it's just such an iconic visual. And when I think about my favorite superhero films, this is in my top five every time. So what are your thoughts? When did you first watch this movie? What do you think about Blade?
So this is one of the first comic book movies that I went and saw in the theaters. And I was just a big fan of Wesley Snipes from Demolition Man and White Man Can't Jump. And I just really liked how charismatic he was and how much presence he had on screen. And when we went, we were not old enough to see this movie, I don't think. I can't remember if it was us or my cousin. One of us had to ask the huge African-American man next to us if he would vouch as our parent when the attendees of the theater came in to try to kick people out because they weren't supposed to be there. That is one of my favorite stories. He was so super cool, and he vouched for us. But as far as the movie goes, you're absolutely right. I like that this guy's there. He's just there for a good time. He has no idea what's going on. And he realizes, I like your analogy, that he's in there with a group of predators. And when he realizes that, he's just fighting for survival to get out. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like he's in this mosh pit of predators who are just looking to beat him, eat him eventually, and kill him. So he's in a fight for survival, but you're right. Then all you see are these black boots, and they pan out, and there's this character. And the minute you see that shot, you're in. You're in. You know that Blade is there to do some serious business. And it just, it's like when, you know, the jackals are around and the lion shows up.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, oh my goodness. And you're right. Blade, in all of his three movies that Wesley Snipes did, they did such a fantastic job of identifying him as a powerful character, somebody with a lot of confidence, and somebody that you wanted to know more about. And he only has maybe two lines in the first 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to do. That's hard to replicate, to get you invested in a character like they did with Blade, without him saying anything.
It just, the look says it all, right? And I think a lot of that credit goes to David Goyer, but also Stephen Norrington. I don't know how much you know about this director, but just that he directed League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, was a movie where Sean Connery quit from the industry. Yeah. He quit. It was fraught with problems, but what I think I sort of understand Norrington a little bit more than most people and his attention to detail.
Yeah.
Because he looked, the sword, the look, the vest. I mean, he analyzed everything. Pearl, that vampire, he had a whole backstory. Everything yes. about it is yes, he had Pearl. Planned. But he started off as makeup effects. So he worked on Greystroke and Gremlins, Return to Oz. He's the guy who helped operate the Gump. So in this film, like what special effect makeup does is you sit there and just with a tiny little pinprick or, you know, a tiny little brush, and you just put hairs in or you paint thumbs. I mean, the attention to detail is insane. And then he moved up, right? He worked on the witches. He did the Grand High Witch. That was his effect. Like, he decorated her, that iconic look. He moved into Alien 3. He did, like, he was on Aliens, too. He worked on the chestburster scenes. He worked on the facehuggers. Then he moved into Waxwork. He moved into Hellraiser. And eventually he got to Blade.
That's a lot of names. That's a lot of movies. I mean, when you just start saying that, when you started mentioning the Alien franchise, I was like, oh my goodness. Because the level of details, not only in the human gore and things like that that happened, but the creature effects, making them believable and making them scary, is a big deal. So I didn't know that. That's good information.
Yeah. And then on top of, so you know what's interesting is, I think he was really interested in, so Wesley Snipes was also a producer on this, and he was interested in the character, but you had this weird symbiotic relationship between, they said it was, the producers of this film said it was kind of like a stool, a three-legged stool. That's the thing they said. It was Wesley Snipes, Goyer, and Norrington. And the three of them somehow gelled together, where Norrington didn't really mess with the script because he was so worried about the look. So I just stuck with Goyer's excellent R-rated, dude. This is a grounded, mean movie. Pearl gets tortured, this evil vampire. It's just, there's so much subtle and cool world building in it. And then you have Wesley Snipes' performance, where when you look back at superhero movies of old, where they fell apart, like Fantastic Four in the 90s, where they fell apart was the fight scenes, right? Or like in the first X-Men in 2000, the first Spider-Man, they were just a little clunky. But I loved how grounded this was. You sort of had Wesley Snipes won a lot of Hong Kong martial arts, spin kicks. And then you also get the greatest superhero landing ever in this film. And so you have this really beautiful looking world that's fleshed out to every single book that you see in the background. You get Snipes at his best and a good script.
And I almost say that's one of the best superhero landings, if not the first one I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
He gets out of the ritual. He gets the blood in his system, and he's going down to fight La Magra. You're absolutely right. That might have been, we might have been witnessing the birth of the superhero landing.
Yes, it was beautiful, and it was just so cool. And I got to tell you, man, I get so annoyed when I see the 56% tomato meter score. And I even get annoyed when I see the 78% audience score, because this movie is at least 145%. For me, it's okay. This is, and I know I'm talking a lot here, man, but you, the last one was on your Venom episode. I love Venom. You didn't. That was a fun ep. And what I like though is this movie, we watch a lot of superhero movies, and a lot of them are good, but none of them have a standout iconic moment. Blade has probably five of them.
Yeah.
You know, ice skating uphill. I love when the cops start shooting Blade. And he's like, "Are you out of your damn mind?" It's like, that was his idea. I love catching of the glasses, the blood rave. I mean, There are just some iconic visuals in this, and they're so memorable.
And coming back to their lair and finding that it's been raided by Deacon Frost, that to me was one of the most powerful scenes in the movie for me personally.
Yeah, because Christofferson, right? You just love that guy, Whistler. And it's pure. It's for me, I never knew about the Blade character. Maybe you can tell me about that. But for me, what I loved was it was just focus on Wesley Snipes' Blade. You also had some really compelling characters. I mean, just the side characters in this I liked. What Ambush Wright as Karen Jensen, this cool doctor who's also a hematologist. You had Deacon Frost, Stephen Dorff. I mean, he wasn't the most physically powerful, but he used technology to read ancient scrolls. He was just smart, and he wasn't complacent. And even Mercury, like for her look is super memorable. Sanaa Lathan is in this movie. Udo Kier, he's just always in vampire films. Donald Logue as Quinn, like just that idiot who always get his butt. But
at the same time, you need a Quinn.
And he was just, there's humor in this, but then there's torture, there's blood, there's death, there's matching henchmen. I don't know why they match, but there are matching henchmen who have beanies and leather jackets that were bought by one company. Do they line up and get this stuff sent to them? Do they dry clean? It's just.
Right. Is there a vampire dry cleaning? Yes or no?
Yeah. We need the. This is the facts. This is what. Yeah. I'm just so excited to talk about this movie, Matt. I'm glad you joined me because I think one thing about you is I was into X-Men in the 90s. I would buy like Turok. I would buy Star Wars comics if I liked the cover. I probably wouldn't even read them. But the only thing I was really invested in was the X-Men. I don't know too much about other comic book characters. I know where this came from. I know what Merv Wolfman created him in 1973, Tomb of Dracula, episode 10.
Yep.
The penciler was Gene Colan. So, like, what did you know about Blade going into this, and what do you know since? Like, how has this character evolved since Blade came out?
So, since Blade came out, obviously that put that character on the map. Now, originally is Eric Brooks, before he becomes Blade, he gets that moniker of Blade, and he was originally designed to look like Jim Brown, the running back from the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
He was meant to look like this big, bustly guy and always be really, really cool, not what you see on the screen. So Wesley and his take on the character have transformed it so much since then. And then, you know, due to the movie success, I remember playing a video game called Marvel Ultimate Alliance, and all of a sudden you can do all this stuff to unlock Blade. And it's like, oh, okay, so now they're starting to really push this character. And since then, I mean, he's been through comics and he's adapted more and more and become a little bit more, I don't want to say more powerful, but he's been more prominent in certain stories, and he's obviously got his own run. But right now I'm reading Venom, the current Venom, and there is a global event happening right now, and Venom gets pulled in with the Avengers, and Blade is an Avenger.
Wow.
And that just tells you the tier from him living in the streets of London, chasing after vampires and dealing with Dracula and being kind of the underbelly, to being somebody who's standing shoulder to shoulder with Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor, and actually being a decision maker is a big deal. So Blade's come a long way, and a lot of that, I think, is due to Wesley Snipes.
Now, I want to ask you another quick question. So I'm going to read you some films, and we're going to kind of talk about whether they affected people's perception of Blade. So in 1994, Fantastic Four, 1995, Judge Dredd, 1995, Tank Girl, 1995, Batman Forever, 1996, Barbed Wire, 1996, Black Mask, 1996, The Phantom, 1997, Batman and Robin, 1997, Men in Black, 1997, Spawn, 1997, Steel, 1998, Blade. Do you think, I mean, aside from Men in Black, since then Tank Girl's become a cult classic.
Yeah.
You know, Black Mask was good. I mean, you got Jet Li. Spawn's become a cult classic. I mean, you just got Michael Jai White and John Leguizamo. It's amazing.
I love that movie. Yeah. As a matter of fact, with John Leguizamo playing the Violator in Spawn, that's a good movie. I enjoyed that one as a kid. I mean, now I don't know if I'd look back at it with different eyes. But as far as what I think may have influenced Blade?
Well, I'm just saying, the dislike of critics. Because do you think they were just tired of subpar superhero films? Do you think that they watched Batman and Robin, Steel, Barbed Wire, Tank Girl, Judge Dredd, and they were just beaten over the head with these weird or over the top superhero films, and they just were tired of it, and that played into some fatigue with Blade as far as critics not liking it, because this is 100 times more fresh than those films were.
And I mean, it doesn't feel like a superhero movie. I think that's what an advantage that it had. Mm-hmm. I think it was a thing where they're like, okay, it's a vampire movie. Then you see the Marvel logo and you're, oh, I had no idea. As far as a casual fan walking in, honestly, I think they probably thought it was going to be just another vampire movie, not the Daywalker, not Wesley Snipes. I don't know. That's a tough question. And I didn't feel like any of those movies would have affected it at all.
Yeah.
Truly.
I guess I'm saying the negative critic score. So maybe critics were just beaten up. Like, they were just so used to beating on these types of films where they just went in ready to tear this one apart. And I don't know. I just wanted to kind of drop that on you. And also, you know, like,
Here's my question. Who are the winners during that time of 1998? What are the movies that were really moving and shaking and getting a lot of good, fresh scores? Because that is probably a reason and how different they are. Like, if Forrest Gump was coming out around then, and then you have Blade, they're like, ah, no, we like this one. So Blade is going to suffer because it's not really going with the Hollywood trend of what's out and what's popular.
That's a great question. I mean, so we had Armageddon, Saving Private Ryan, Godzilla, There's Something About Mary, and let's see, A Bug's Life, Deep Impact, Mulan, Dr. Dolittle, Shakespeare in Love, Lethal Weapon 4. Those were the highest grossing movies.
You look at those movies, every single one of them seemed to, except for like Something About Mary, seemed to be on a much bigger scale, and a lot of stars in those movies. Look at the cast of Armageddon. Seeing a lot of big names, and then you see two that aren't really that big. Wesley Snipes, Stephen Dorff. Nobody's really looking at that and going, wow, this is a star-studded movie. And then, you know, some of those are kind of seated in reality-ish. Does that make sense? Like, not Bug's Life or anything like that, but like Armageddon.
Saving Private Ryan. I mean, even Godzilla, they toned it down to be more... Okay, it wasn't just Godzilla and another monster battling. They tried to make it more grounded, I would say, the latest Godzilla. But then they forgot about actually making Godzilla interesting.
That's a good point.
I guess Lethal Weapon 4, you had the great Jet Li fight. But it just, I don't know. I know we can't get into critics' heads. And, I mean, the 90s vampire movies were popular, and it just seemed... I mean, this movie was still a success. On a $45 million budget, it made $130 million. And it did kick off the superhero film big time. Because look at after this movie came out, right? So after it comes out, we get 2000 X-Men, 2000 Unbreakable, 2002 Spider-Man, 2002 Blade 2, Hulk, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Daredevil. Like, it just got, I don't know, like they got bigger and better. So I think Blade really did influence. And Marvel was in trouble in the 90s. They were not.
They were selling properties left and right. They couldn't make movies.
Yep. And then they had this hit. And I think, I'm telling you, this movie helped. I know The Crow was good. I love The Crow. Dark City wasn't that much of a success, but that wasn't a comic book movie. But I know we're getting lost here in it. But it just, I think Blade to me is just so influential and so good that Marvel fans nowadays, they just don't. And I mean, true, it's 98. It's like over 20 years old. Jeez Louise.
They don't appreciate the fact because. We talked about this on Alter Ego podcast. People hailed Chadwick Boseman as the first ever African-American superhero movie lead.
Yeah.
And forget, we go back and forget that Blade was the first guy to do it and do it really, really well. And then after that, you even mentioned Spawn. Spawn had done it too.
Yeah.
Michael White. But as far as the Marvel properties go, Wesley Snipes and Blade was the first one. And I think truly that Blade one still holds up with almost any of the Marvel properties that are coming out right now in terms of tone and the way the character is. I just feel like he's very polarizing.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I love it. I love this movie. And I love this movie so much, I figured out how much blood came out of those sprinklers in the beginning and how those vampires are able to set that up.
How many gallons of it?
Yeah, 400. I guess at, let's see, where's my final math? So here's what I did. I analyzed the party. And in the film, there's two different sprinkler systems. So it looks like they installed a sprinkler system specifically for the blood. Mm-hmm. And then they have another one there that must be for a fire. So they built this blood rave area so that they could have blood raves with yuppie vampires, I think. I think these are yuppie vampires who are wasteful, wasting animal blood because it's the packing plant where we saw.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. How much of that do you think is animal blood and how much of that was human blood?
So, you know, they had humans in the background. So I'm pretty sure they had to have done that, had some human blood, but then they're not really drinking it, right? They're just sort of letting it wash over them.
Yeah.
Like, you and I we're hungry guys. If we're at a party and they're just dropping delicious IPAs from the ceiling, I'm drinking it,
yeah.
Right? If brownies are coming from the ceiling, I'm eating those things. But in this one, they're just kind of letting the blood wash on them. So that's why I think it might be animal blood. I don't know if you think about that. But I've come to the conclusion that somewhere between 425 gallons of blood poured out of them, which means they drain blood from either 41 cows or 283 adults. Ooh. Or they collected 3,400 one-pint donations from the blood banks they have all over the world.
Now, that's interesting. That, I think, is probably the more plausible reason or for them to have that much blood.
Because
they're also screening whatever they're draining and sending into the sprinklers.
Yeah, right? It's
maybe that's why they're not drinking it, too, is because it's not coming straight from the victim. This it looks like it's watered down blood, and maybe it's more for appearance, although you do see a couple of the vampires with their mouths full and trying to drink it in that scene.
It's just what I like about it is in a lot of films, we get vampires who need the blood. They don't waste the blood. In the 90s, From Dusk Till Dawn, I think they definitely wasted some blood. But normally these vampires, they kind of live in the shadows and they aren't just sending blood flying everywhere. They sort of need it. So I just love this visual of these new partying young in quotation marks,
right?
Wasting blood, because that's not something Udo Kier would do. That's not something the main vampires would do.
The Lestats of the world, yeah.
Yeah, Lestat's not doing a blood. That'd be awesome. Tom Cruise is just dancing like in Tropic Thunder with blood all over him.
Or he's because in Anne Rice, I'm pretty sure Lestat was a rock star.
Yep.
His whole vibe was the fact that he was out at night and he was a vampire, air quotes, even though he really was one.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. You don't see that. And they also touch on that when he goes to speak to the ancient pure blood vampires. You know, they're like, our ability to survive has been based on our ability to blend in. So why are you doing this? They kind of look at Frost like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You're wasting all this blood. You're openly attacking people in these clubs. You know, you're not really they basically accuse him of not being a vampire. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting, too, where they're old. They're what? They were born vampires, I suppose. They're pure bloods. I don't know how that works. But it's that brings up whole new things about their anatomy. And also the fact that some vampires turn into zombies and eat anything, or maybe even vampires. There's a world that they just drop, dude. That's right. Awesome. That
doctor, they said, you know, something went wrong when he was turning.
Yeah.
So he doesn't die, but he doesn't live, and he doesn't turn into a vampire, so he's kind of a zombie. They even say the word zombie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow.
There's a lot of lore. Vampire lore here. I mean, they go out and they put sunblock on. There's bullet time actually in this movie, somewhat bullet time. They don't have the multiple cameras surrounding the person, but Stephen Dorff in 98 dodged bullets a year before Matrix was dodging bullets. Now, I know they were in Australia making the movie, but it's, I don't know. There's so much about this movie. And
it goes against vampire lore as well in this movie. Things like you just brought up, like in a lot of other movies and vampire lore, the older the vampire, the more powerful they are.
Yeah, and you're right.
In this one, these purebred that have been alive for thousands and thousands of years are scared of Deacon Frost, who's a bit vampire who just turns. When you look at vampire lore, you're like, wait a minute, they're not supposed to be afraid of him.
Oh, yeah,
if that makes sense. And not another two, he smokes in the movie several times, and in almost every other vampire movie, if they ingest anything other than blood, they become violently sick or possibly even die.
Yeah, they pull What We Do in the Shadows, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's drinking What We Do in the Shadows. They drink the blood and they don't understand that he gets sick.
Oh, that's perfect. Holy mackerel.
I love Nandor.
Have you watched the movie?
Sorry, I don't know if I can cut.
That's fine. Have you watched the movie?
No. So Robert Lamb, who's a mutual friend of ours who does Seven Lamb Productions, I've been begging him to watch the show, and he won't watch the show until he watches the movie. So he just watched the movie. Now he got to watch the show, so I need to watch the movie to get caught up now. But that's neither here nor there. But when he goes – it's back to what I was saying about the kind of – I don't want to say inconsistencies because it's their own world. They build it the way they want. I'm in.
Can I interrupt you real quick about something? Just one quick annoyance. This is like, you know what annoys me about vampire lore? They're fictional. Now, they are based on – I did a Count Chocula video about if Count Chocula is related to the Habsburgs and related to Dracula. So I studied vampire lore, and it's just people digging up bodies in cold areas assuming they're vampires. Just lore, right, to keep people afraid or lack of information. So – like you said, I hate when people are like, that's not what vampires do. I hate sparkly vampires. Vampires have no rules. Sorry, that was my rant. They're fictional.
Right.
Yeah. Make up whatever you want.
And I agree. I'm just saying that Blade definitely, and it speaks to what you were saying, their own lore is what they created. Because when they're in that little, I don't know, the club where the girls are rapping, where they eventually find Pearl, all those vampires are watching Blade like, what is this guy doing here? But if you look, they're all drinking beer.
Yep.
Smoking.
Yeah.
And there's a club in the back. I'm like, in this world, are vampires able to still eat and drink?
I think they are, because remember when she's talking to Deacon later on, saying that you're a half-breed, where you can be turned back. You just have a genetic flaw in you. So there's this weird thing where they're not, like, they're maybe not undead, because they can still regenerate. Like, so if you are a vampire and you can regenerate, that means your insides are not dead. They're just mutated. So maybe they can eat a blood burger or a blood pop or smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
A bong and a blintz, a pipe and a crepe.
And another question is it the same rules where if you bite somebody who is drunk or high, you assume the effects of the chemistry in their blood and you in turn become drunk or high from doing it?
I would say so. I was in a band called the Brewskies, and we opened up for this guy called the Unknown Hinson. That his whole bit was that he was a vampire, and we wrote a song specifically called "A Vampire Drank My Blood and She Got Drunk," because we were the Brewskies, and that was our song. So I think so, man. If you're drinking someone, if someone's been shooting tequila all night and you drink their blood, you're gonna get a rush.
Yeah. it makes all the sense in the world, to be honest with you.
But that's what I love about this world, though. And you know what's funny? I never picked up on the cigarette smoking. But they don't mention it. Udo Kier doesn't run into the room and go, "Deacon, what are you doing? We can't do that." There's no. And then he puffs on the cigarette, and then Udo pukes because he's a pure blood. But that's really funny. They really are quite fast and loose, but it still feels more grounded, right? It's interesting.
You also mentioned him being able to stay outside.
Yeah.
Sun. That was another one that I was like, this is a little iffy here. If all vampires knew that all they had to do was put on some SPF 8000 and they could go outside for a few minutes, you know, why aren't more of them doing it? Not to mention, how does he put sunblock on his eyeballs? Because those are still out in the sun.
That's a great question. Maybe he was in the shade. He wasn't in the shade. You know, if I was Blade, I would track massive sunblock sales.
There you go.
Well, only 8,000. Like, I wouldn't be worried about 45. I would be worried about, man, that vampire, those people just ordered a case of SPF 12 million.
Right.
I need to go hunt them down.
Right. Or he's tracking the sale of the chemicals used to make it. Really powerful sunblock.
Yeah. But you know what, though? Like you said, it's just fictional again. And maybe these half-breeds are more maybe sunlight doesn't affect them as much. I love how we're going like half-breeds, full-breeds. Because they have some maybe human blood still in them or human genetics still in them because they aren't really dead?
Yeah.
Because, all right, I have a question. You're a dead vampire. You can't grow your arm back. Like, the vampires from Dusk Till Dawn, they could not grow their arms back, could they?
Correct. No, I don't believe so. If they suffered a big wound like that, they were living with it. I mean, sure, I think the wound could close, but we're also talking about a different breed of vampire in Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah, that's true.
Those vampires were much more about body mutilation and physically destroying their prey than, say, Blade, where they want to bite the neck and drink the blood.
Got it. Those and they just want to sip on blood from chalices. You apart.
Right. Those vampires were going to rip your arm off and drink your blood like it was a boot. You know what I mean?
They were going to beer fest and turn the boot.
Exactly. Remember to turn the arm. Ah, he's a lefty. What are you doing?
Blood fest.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. The good ideas just start flowing.
Imagine that. Everyone, like, just vampire, goth vampires. Then you have the body, like, the weird vampires. Then you get the Transylvanian vampires.
Yep, with their wool cloaks.
I mean, they had everyone from every Canadian, Australian. They're all still the stereotypes that they were from Beer Fest, but they're just vampires.
Yep, I love it.
And there's just scared people in cages all over the place.
Right, we're just hoping that they don't get drunk.
This movie sounds kind of great.
The movie's from the point of view of the guy in the last cage.
We need another one. Oh, man. Right.
He eventually starts cheering for the German vampires because he knows they can shut everybody down and he won't get drunk.
Yeah, exactly. No sudden death. No overtime. Yeah. Oh, gosh. And then they're like, the winner gets the last guy. And you're like, oh, man.
Oh, man. That's their prize at the end is the last guy.
And just the hope sinks. You're happy. Then you just get, oh, man, they played me. That was terrible. Now, before we move on, I just want to drop one cool thing on you. So, one thing that I think is really funny. So, movie franchises with one-word titles, like that are weapons, such as Saw, Blade, Machete, and Hatchet. So, Blade has a tomato meter average of 46. Saw has one of 28%. Machete's 50%. And Hatchet's 55. So, none of them have what you would call a fresh average. Right. And they're all one-word titles, Saw, Blade, Hatchet, Machete, these franchises. And so none of them are above 60%.
And 60 is considered fresh.
Yeah, I just think it's funny that one-word movie titles that feature a weapon, a sawing-type weapon, are rotten. It just makes me happy. I just want, maybe that's a theme right there. Maybe that's just what people hate seeing one-word titles of something that could cut you.
You just hurt my heart that Machete outscored Blade.
Ah, Machete don't text. Oh. Now, the good news is that the audience score for Blade 68%, so it's higher than Saw, Machete, and Hatchet. But Hatchet and Machete beat out Blade and Saw. But if you think about it, well, Blade, I mean, Hatchet and Machete are really seem like blunt force instruments. Blade could be a myriad of things.
Really could.
And Saw just seems nasty. Like, that's why it's the lowest, right? Because to Saw, you just got to go up and down. But this is a weird.
It is, but I'm rolling with it.
Yeah, you know, it just makes me happy that
Machete's definitely. You don't see somebody using any sort of finesse when carrying a machete at all. It's always gonna be a swing from over the head down to either foliage or what have you.
Oof. Yeah, and that's not gonna be pretty.
Saw's up close and has to be oscillating back and forth. Blade. There's a couple of different things, but Hatchet is another one that requires a lot of get up and go, a lot of a swing, you know what I mean? And maybe another overhead. So maybe that's what it is. The effort to use the one word weapon in your title is how high your critic score is going to be.
Oh, I love that.
So now we just need to make the movie Scythe.
Wow.
We might really be onto something.
We could be the first fresh one.
Yeah.
Scythes are interesting because if I'm in a tight corridor, unless he wraps around me, then pulls the scythe towards me, then you're in a lot of trouble. But if you're tight corridoring, I want to fight the villain from Scythe.
Yeah.
But if I'm in a cornfield, give me Hatchet all day or give me Saw all day.
Scythe is in pre-production right now.
What's the villain in Scythe?
So it just says a disgraced FBI agent is tasked with. Hold on, I got to get my movie voice for this. Right.
Here we go.
A disgraced FBI agent is tasked with finding the Grim Reaper killer after he escapes from a prison transport in North Carolina on prom night. Breaks into a hardware store. Sorry, I'm not making it.
He bursts into a farm and grabs a scythe from
and kills the owner's daughter.
Scythe. Scythe 2. Back at it.
Yeah.
Scythe 3. Again.
Yeah. Scythe 3, it's not over.
Scythe 4, he's back. Scythe 5, the one where another copycat killer is the villain.
Scythe 6, are you still there?
Scythe 7, psych.
Wait, what?
And that's the quality one, Scythe 7. Yeah. That's the one where they finally bring in Christian Slater, and he revives the franchise.
And it's a little too late, so it becomes this cult classic where everyone's like, have you seen Scythe 7, psych? It's really meta, and it's... And it's,
they almost lost me on Scythe 6, are you still there, but...
Man, like, there's a scene in 7 where there's someone's watching Scythe 1 on a TV, but then the Scythe killer's still in it.
Yeah.
And by this point, Christian Slater is the son of the hero from the first one.
Right, who's still disgraced, even in 7.
Wow. So he was disgraced through 7 films?
That's right. He never gets his redemption. That's why Scythe keeps coming back.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it's... Oh, wait! In Scythe 5, you find out that Scythe is the disgraced FBI agent.
Wow.
Oh.
It's what... And, you know, the creative team from the first two came back for 7. So you can tell that they really were able to bring the gore effects.
Yep.
Yeah, 7... What I think I like about 7 is the way it's meta, but it's not owned by meta, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's breaking the mold.
Yeah, you just don't want something too meta. That's why you want half and half, like Scream, where it gets it, but it's still really bloody.
Yeah. This one has a lot more story. There's still a good enough amount of gore, but the story's actually grabbing me.
The thing about the Scythe, too, is... When you have a saw or a hatchet, it's just one person, right? You're just hatcheting one person.
Right.
But with a scythe, I mean, you're partying. Like, you could wipe out 4 or 5 people.
100%. Here's the thing.
Spin in a circle. Oh, my gosh. At a line dance. He goes into a line dance and just starts spinning in a circle.
It's achy, breaky heart in the background. Don't tell my heart. My achy, breaky heart. Until at the end, it's just him.
And then there's people inside of the Scythe circle, and they're just running as fast as they can.
Right. Like they're in a turnstile door.
Yeah, and they're so...
Oh, man.
That'd be... Wow. Yeah. And it turns out there's 2 of them, and they think they're safe inside the Scythe circle.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. That's the best part of
Scythe 2. Scythe
7. Psych. All right. My mind's blown. So let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will talk more Blade. We will be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And I just wanted to drop something on you about how this movie has stayed. And maybe it's because of our age, and maybe it's just because of what keeps things in the press. But I don't know if you remember, but about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, I got over 350 lists. From people, I think 350, somewhere in there, of people ranking their 5 favorite superhero films. Doesn't matter what they were. Didn't have to be in order. It just had to be their 5 favorite, not best, superhero films. Right. So on all these lists, I ended up getting Dark Knight was 123 on 123 of the list. Spider-Man 2 was on 73. Logan was on 69. Captain America, Winter Soldier, 65. Avengers Endgame, 59. And that was tied with Into the Spider-Verse, which also had 59.
That's a fantastic movie.
And so, but at the bottom of the table, which it wasn't horrible, we had Blade 2 with 14 and Blade on 13, which means they appeared on 13 and 14 of the list. Now we have Cap 1 that wasn't really on there. We had Thor 1 and 2 that weren't on there. The Hulk movies weren't on there. Daredevil. I mean, we're talking 30 other superhero films that didn't make it. Yeah. So... Blade and Blade 2 aren't Dark Knight level, which nothing can be, but they're also not Punisher Warzone level, which is beautiful. So I guess that's nice to know, right? Is that while they're not on many lists, they'll still pop up, unlike some movies, which I think is fair. Because for me, it's top 5, right? Top 5 for me. But... Dude, this doesn't belong up in the echelons of Spider-Verse, does it? But I think it does.
I think it does.
Yeah.
I think talking different tones here.
Yeah, you're right.
I think superhero movies can't all be thrown under one single boom, superhero. I think you need to break it up a little bit, because Into the Spider-Verse definitely can hang with some great movies, but you wouldn't compare it to something like Blade, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And you wouldn't compare Avengers Age of Ultron, Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's just different feels.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, they're heroes, but they're completely different.
No, I gotcha. And that's, but do you think that's the problem? I don't think most people think like you, Jack, because that's rational. So, I mean, it's right. And to be fair, I think Dark Knight's a great film, work of art. Like, I figured out how much cash was in that pile in The Dark Knight. Like, that's been a great post for me. Yeah. But
by the way, that is my favorite. That's number one for me. I think that's the best made comic book movie, if you're going to throw them all into one, of all time.
And I just like that it stays grounded, and it the biggest part that annoys me about The Dark Knight is that everyone just goes, the Joker represents chaos and anarchy. No, he doesn't.
No,
the Joker had an entire plan set in motion, A, B, C, D, laminated, tailored suits. So he wants to cause chaos, and he could be considered a force of chaos, but a very organized, controlled chaos. So
he even names himself the agent of chaos in the movie, but I disagree. The Joker does not represent chaos. I think Gotham City represents chaos.
Mm.
Personally, because they are a product of their... Well, I mean, the Joker and Batman are a product of their environment, right?
Yeah.
Joker definitely is tailored. He was calculated from the first frame to the last one. So to call him chaos, I disagree.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, some of the things he did caused chaos, but that was intentional.
Exactly. So I guess I get annoyed. I love the movie, but there's people really reading it wrong. But then I'm just the grumpy man in the corner hating on a very good film. So, hey, kids, go watch Scythe 7.
You don't appreciate Heath Ledger.
Go watch Scythe 7, psych. Yeah, but I guess for me, I don't know why Blade doesn't pop up in the conversation more. And after I was reading about it, like, it's really interesting what they said too. The head of New Line, Mike DeLuca, said, "I'll make it for $40 million if you can get Denzel Washington, $35 million if you can get Wesley Snipes, and $20 million if you can get Lawrence Fishburne." So they had three people in mind. They got Wesley Snipes. They got their $35 million, which in '98 was really good. And I think I don't know, man. It's this movie in '98. I don't know.
This may be an unpopular opinion because I love Denzel Washington. I think he's extraordinarily talented. I don't think Blade is as successful with Denzel compared to Wesley Snipes.
No, and I think you're right. And when you think about Denzel, you know, he has done some physicality in Equalizer, The Hurricane. I mean, he was excellent. But just the overall, like, Denzel's great. Like, listen, he's an Oscar winner. He's a top tenner. I think just the attitude and action and the way Wesley Snipes Snipes embodied Blade. And so you're able to see Blade as Blade, not really Wesley Snipes. And as excellent as Denzel Washington is, I mean, Malcolm X is just amazing. And Training Day. I mean, we could just sit here and name all of his movies.
We really Fallen. Could.
I think you're right. Going. This movie got it. It understood it. And it,
A big part of Blade is the physicality, and one thing that I wanted to – not just him standing in a room and his presence, but when he's going back after – by the way, we watched this last night, and a funny story real quick. My son was watching parts of this with us, which I had to, you know, okay, leave the room for a second for a couple of them. But at the end, when he's coming back, and I'll circle to my point, I swear, the security guard comes to Deacon and goes, "Deacon, we've got an intruder." My son looks at me and goes, "I hope his name doesn't start with a B." I'm pretty sure it does.
Oh, but that's amazing.
When those generic sequenced henchmen are coming in, Blade does this little Jeet Kune Do thing where he bounces up and down. And the way he moves his body and the way he's fighting, you can tell, oh, he knows what he's doing. He's not doing that for show. He's doing that because he's fully confident in what he's about to do, and that makes the character even more believable.
It's beautiful. And I mean, you look at the people who worked on this. They had Jeff Amata, the guy who choreographed the fights in Mortal Kombat, and They Live, that epic street fight. Then you have you have Jeff Ward, who has worked on Hellboy, Inside Man, Black Klansman, The Five Bloods, Malcolm X, a stunt coordinator. I mean, you had some of the best martial artists. Like, they brought in some excellent martial artists from Hong Kong. They really, you watch this again, and it's, you know, that you put the henchmen in the outfit so you can reuse them. So I get it. It's fine. Saved on budget. It wasn't the biggest budgeted film. But it's, I loved watching these fights and the kicks. And, when, you know, they even hide that girl that starts kicking him that we meet earlier at the Duncan Frost loft. And then she starts kicking him.
Video games when he's walking around hearing from Pearl about LaMagra and how it works.
Mm-hmm.
She's sitting there watching video games and looking up. And that was another one of those things, because in vampire communities, children were forbidden. They couldn't be vampires because then they would live forever as little vampires.
And he just takes her in there, and then she just starts kicking him. It's just excellent. Yeah, that move he does, the one when he throws his blade, then he catches it.
Yeah.
When he just putting the sword down, doing the stances. I mean, it's just so cool. It's such a cool movie. And one thing I really don't like is, I enjoy Blade 2. We did an episode on it. I bought the Blu-ray, listened to all 47 commentaries, because Guillermo del Toro loads his stuff up, which is amazing. I love exploring his films. Yeah. I love Blade 2, but I think it became more about sort of the CGI fights, and then, which is fine. They had superhero fights before superhero fights were super huge. I mean, Spider-Man, stuff like that. As much as I don't know, the Wolfpack is cool. Nyssa's cool. She, you know, the point I don't like about Blade 2 is she fights Blade to a standstill in the beginning of the film, and at the end, she's completely helpless.
Helpless, can't fight.
I hated that. And then Blade 3, my friend Norbert, who joins the show a lot, you know, a great friend, he's on a lot of MFF episodes. We were talking about it, and a lot of the negativity about Blade 3 has come from Patton Oswalt's comments about Wesley Snipes on set. And Wesley Snipes recently was like, that's all BS. I was a producer. It was a huge set. I was always in the Blade character. I was always, like, there's nothing new about that. Like, this is not an issue at all. He's like, why does people even just believe Patton Oswalt? Like, none of this is true. He's like, imagine being Wesley Snipes, right?
Where did Patton Oswalt? I haven't read these comments, so I'm going in blind. Yeah. So you can educate me, but I know that where did Patton Oswalt hear these comments? Because from what I heard, Jessica Biel and Ryan Reynolds were kind of saying the same thing.
Now, here's the thing: from you're Wesley Snipes, you have taken Blade and Blade 2 to new heights. You have this world on your back. And you are a producer, and this world has made a lot of money, and by 2004 on Blade Trinity, this was supposed to be the swan song to your trilogy. But instead, you're
finally introducing Dracula.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, David Goyer steps up to direct. He's a great writer, but his movies Zigzag, Invisible, and Unborn, they're all 10%, 20% movies. Like, they're not good. So you have a relatively inexperienced director, and you're bringing in Ryan Reynolds and Jessica Biel and Parker Posey, who's the best part of that movie, and Dracula. Oh,
come on.
Oh, she earns her paycheck. She's amazing.
Triple H brought that movie.
Oh, yeah, Triple H. You get the WWE crowd. And this is you. This is your film. And nothing about Blade Trinity even matches anything from Blade 1 or 2. I remember I went to, the big cinema in downtown Baywalk in St. Pete? I went to go watch it. And I was really disappointed because I wanted Blade, and it's not a Blade movie. So I think if you're Wesley Snipes, you're always in character. You're not being used much. Like, Ryan Reynolds said that, like, he was in character. And they just seemed like they were – so, okay, Blade was never jokey-jokey. And remember in the second one, the humor came from him shining the red light at Ron Perlman's balls during that scene, or saying, ooh, I'm so scared, like just real –
yeah.
Ooh, come get me. Yeah. But then you get a motor mouth. So Wesley Snipes is in character. How are you going to play off this motor mouth? You're not. He was never jokey. So all these comments that they have, I was not there. Maybe they're right. Maybe they're wrong. But you're in character. You're Blade. You've been this way for two pictures, and that they've been successful because of you. Now you get these jokey 20-something-year-olds who listen to music while shooting bow and arrows and all this stuff. It's not. It's. And I think the director, it was big. He didn't have much money. He didn't have much experience. So I could see Snipes being annoyed. Yeah, and they said that Snipes communicated by post-it note to the director. Yeah. Well, he's in character. He needed to talk to this director who, days went long. So I just, I don't know.
Two things.
He could have been badly behaved, sure. But I also, I don't like how people just – were so quick to dogpile on him because of something Patton Oswalt and a few other people said. I think they did a disservice to the character of Blade and Blade Trinity.
You're right. And let's talk about the fact that Patton Oswalt's level of involvement in the movie and Wesley Snipes' level of involvement in the movie, there's shades of gray there. But yeah. A lot of people don't know. Wesley Snipes did his press tour in character. He stayed dressed up as Blade and did his interviews like that. So your comments that he stayed in character the whole time, absolutely. It's his baby. He was trying to truly push that character to the forefront and make it something. I mean, even when they were talking about recasting and doing Mahershala Ali in the new Blade, there were still talks about bringing Wesley Snipes back.
Mm-hmm. I just think put yourself in Wesley Snipes' shoes. And we weren't there.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard to do that. But I also think just straight up blame Wesley Snipes when you had your baby taken away from you. And it was a cynical cash grab. You have a movie with Dracula, Jack, and he's just some bald dude. Like, it's not this interesting.
Bald, muscular guy who did not, to me, have the presence of a Dracula.
Didn't even have anywhere near the presence of Stephen Dorff or the other actor.
But that's the point that you made a lot earlier when we were talking about the Blade one and why do we think it was so successful? It's because it was so grounded and it's Blade and Deacon Frost. That's it, right? I mean, you have other factors, but the two things are Blade in his camp, Deacon in his camp, and they're at opposite ends and they're moving towards an ultimate conclusion. Now, when you go to Blade 2, there's Blade, the Blood Pack representing vampires, and I forget the name of what they ended up calling them.
Kojak, the Reapers, right?
The Reapers.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, and the main Reaper's name was
Kovac
or Womack.
Yeah, one of those. Lee Womack. Is that what you're thinking?
That seemed a little clunky to me, but still it works because you still have the same vibe. You know, at the end of the day, it's Blade against the main Reaper, and you get the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have Blade 3. You have the vampires. You have Blade. Now you introduce Abigail Whistler and Hannibal King, who Hannibal King is an extraordinarily big character for comic book fans.
Hmm.
So he's a big character in Blade lore. So for him to be like, okay, and not just that, but now you have Wesley Snipes, oh my gosh, I said her name, Jessica Biel, Ryan Reynolds, then you have Parker Posey and Triple H and all these big characters that want their own screen time, and you lose the essence of why this movie was so good in the first place. It's because you focused on Blade and his mission. And too many cooks, man, throwing too many things into the plot, and it fell apart.
If you think about the Blood Pack, I mean, even Scud, Norman Reedus from 2, but you had Matt Schultz as Chupa, or Ron Perlman as Reinhardt, Donnie Yen Snowman. You just had Tony Corena's Priest. Those guys, they just were very in the Blade world as far as the character of Blade. The tone was the same. So I get annoyed when people just start making fun of Snipes for Blade 3 because it's very short-sighted to me. And obviously, I'm going to say it again for the 40th time, we weren't there. But it's just, I don't know, it doesn't gel. And I know we're supposed to be talking about Blade, but
it's a big thing of why we wanted this movie to be so good. Mm-hmm. We wanted Blade to be good. So, I mean, it's I don't know. It's easy to tear it apart when you're Patton Oswalt and you're somebody who was just there for a minute role. And then it doesn't go well. And, well, why didn't it go well, Patton? Well, let me tell you.
You know what? It is too. Whenever I watch Blade, I dislike Blade Trinity much more. So my dislike of Blade Trinity dissipates the further I've been from watching Blade.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? But when I watch Blade, it just boils back up again, and I'm like, oh, I'm annoyed. So it.
I agree.
It's kind of a shame because let's say even the first two films, they were really excellent and they told good stories. I do think Blade 2 gets a little carried away with the family and then the ultimate vampire, then the son, then the daughter, and then the wolf pack. But, I mean, there's still some legit fights. I mean, there's a flying CGI elbow drop on Blade. Yeah. That's
yes, there is.
That there's a suplex. I mean, and what I like too is that that one brought in superhero fights, and it, Donnie Yen choreographed one of the fights, and I dig that about it. I like the sewer scene a lot. Actually, I thought that was really cool.
So, I thought that was one of the best shot scenes in the whole series.
Yeah,
That sequence of events, from them being in the sewer to them trying to get out, is one of the best action sequences to me, period. I just love it. As far as comic book movies go, yeah, man, the intensity that's built from them being these elite. It's like we said with Blade One, the elite, the hunters becoming the hunted.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Wow. So in the beginning, the vampires are hunted and they're afraid of Blade. But then you have the vampire hunters and Blade being afraid of the Reapers. And right. Nomak was his name.
I found it and I was going to tell you.
Greer, Kovac, Djokovic.
Nomak.
Yeah. Novak, Djokovic. Yeah. And my favorite superhero films, right, are Unbreakable, where you have a Mr. Glass trying to find someone who's unbreakable and this person learning their powers. And in Unbreakable, there's this scene where there's this man in an orange jumpsuit and he's just spitting beer on this dead woman tied to a radiator. It's one of the most haunting visuals, and I've seen pretty much every horror movie that has haunting visuals. There still are some, but... And then I love Batman Forever, just how... I mean, you just had Danny DeVito biting noses and eating a fish. Weird fish. And I just love the meat and... Even that movie had a decent amount of characters, but they never lost the characters. And so I like these grounded... I mean, as grounded as Batman Forever... Or not Batman Forever, Batman Returns is... I just like the smaller scale stuff, and that's why I love Blade. It's very meat and potatoes. There's believable world building. We're shown, not told in some instances. And it's just fun, and there's iconic visuals. And most of these adventure comic book movies I watch, I forget about, and this one's definitely not one of them. It's right up there with Scythe 7, Psych.
Now, when you list all those movies that are your favorites, the one thing that stands out to me... when you just start naming them, like when you say Unbreakable, Blade, what were the other ones that you
Batman
mentioned?
Batman Returns with Batman Michelle Returns. Pfeiffer and Catwoman and all that.
Right. So of those three, all three of those movies have great heroes, great people that we follow. But even more so, it's the villains. It's the iconic villains that tie you in to that's why this is such a good movie. That's honestly why Dark Knight is my favorite movie, because I loved when Heath Ledger was on screen. It's the one of those times where you're like, oh, man, is my guy going to lose?
Yeah.
It puts you in that sense. You know, it gets you emotionally invested. And that's one of those things when we look back and analyze, you could identify with Deacon Frost to an extent.
To an extent. Just annoyed. And he's just using and everyone tells him he can't do things.
Yeah.
He's happily evil. He never kills Donald Logue's character, which makes me happy because, you know, when henchmen fail, henchmen die.
Yes, yes.
And I dug that. And also, I thought it was really interesting. There's a scene where Blade does a superhero landing. Let's see. Mercury jumps in front of Deacon, who's now the Blood God. It's a weird scene, but it just... the people seem to love working for Deacon.
they love him. And that's the thing, too, because my wife watched it with me, and she... did not remember this movie at all. And as soon as he comes back and Deacon's telling him, I want him alive, and he's like, dude, you have no idea. We've been trying to get this guy forever.
Yes.
All my family was like, oh, this guy's dead. Yeah. I remember the movie. I was like, no, he's not. But you're right. They love him. He's like, I need you, man. Let all these other guys go. I need you.
You never see that coming. And yeah. He's sort of the voice of the audience a little bit. And then he just gets wiped out. And it's just, for me, when I think about Blade 2, there are some really iconic scenes for sure. And then Blade 3, I couldn't name it. I mean, just the whole, I don't want to say it on the pod, but the insults Ryan Reynolds calls Parker Posey, who they should just have their own movie and not call it Blade. It's called Vampire Hustlers or Chucklers.
That was originally going to be a spinoff, was it? There was going to be a Hannibal King spinoff from Blade 3. Or actually, it was, what were they called?
Yeah, the Night Stalkers.
Night Stalkers. There was going to be a Night Stalker spinoff with Jessica Biel and Ryan Reynolds.
Just, hey, let's finish a trilogy and trying to make money. But I don't remember that. And just, but Blade, it's just the superhero landing, the blood rave, the like you said, that step he does, just the fights. And it's
now, like, when you talk to me about this episode and what you want. I said, oh, what do you want? What do you want me to know? What do you want me to talk about? You said, think about three scenes that you want to bring up and talk about.
Yeah, let's do that now. Before we let's finish it up by talking about our three favorite scenes. You want to do that?
Yeah.
All right. Cool. What do you got?
So, I'll go from from last to first.
So least awesome to awesome to more awesome to most awesome.
Yes. Least awesome, but still one of my absolute favorite scenes is after Whistler is dead, and they've taken the doctor, the hematologist, and he is sitting there preparing for battle, and he takes that orchid out of the box. And looks at it and cuts it in half. People are like, well, why is he doing that? What is the point of this, right? I had to look too, because I had to research. I was like, why did they make a point to set up a shot with him looking at an orchid and then cutting the roots out of it, right? That was symbolism for his independence, right? So that flower, that orchid, represented his roots, which are the people who made him Whistler, all of the people he worked with, and his mother, the vampire that bit his mother. That's what that represented to him. And the plant was what he became out of that. And so him cutting the roots out of that plant was showing his independence and saying, I don't need to be this anymore. I don't need to worry about this part of me. That's over. I'm moving forward. So that was, you know, to symbolize that when he cuts the plant.
Oh, man, that's deep.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, he made a big point to do this. He was very purposeful when he was doing things, right? He was like, oh, here's a plant. Okay. It was a big thing for it to be there, be in a good setup, and pull it out, look at it, and there you could tell there's a lot of emotion in his face. And I was like, why is he so intense on looking at this? And that scene really resonated with me for the rest of the movie.
Oh, I love it. That's beautiful. This is a really weird scene, and I don't want people to think I'm like sick in the head for it, but the scene where they just torture Pearl.
Yes.
It's really brutal and it's really mean. And these are our heroes Neuer, I just want to bring this up too. Norrington wanted Pearl. The reason it was so big is because it just ate a lot of babies and just laid there and got huge on murdering things. But when Karen Jensen just sits there, she's just lighting it up while Blade's using this gel to blow up a massive door. It gives it an edge, I guess, for me. Is I like my movies to have a little bit of an edge. Maybe also think about Unbreakable with that scene, or the nose biting in Batman for Returns. I guess I do like that added meanness or added cruelty that I think sets it apart. They're not afraid to be a little mean or a little cruel or startle people. They're not trying to go for 1.2 billion worldwide by watering it down. And that part I just loved. I thought it was great. And
the reason I love that is a little bit different, because I tried to kind of step into Karen's shoes when that happened. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, she is a hematologist working in a hospital. Out of nowhere, this cadaver comes to life, kills her ex-boyfriend, bites her, and turns her into a vampire, air quotes. She then meets up with Blade, who tells her, these vampires are going to hunt you and kill you for the rest of your life. And no, there's really nothing you can do about it. And if you turn into a vampire, put a gun on your head and shoot yourself. And it's like, wow. So all of this she's gone into, and everything she's doing, she's following Blade. And she first goes home, the cop shows up to kill her because she was associated with these vampires. Everywhere she goes, they're stronger, they're more powerful. If it's not for Blade, she's dead. So here she is in this position of power with Pearl, who is a vampire, who is representing all of these things that have basically ruined her life. And this is her first opportunity to do anything. And I think it wasn't about torturing Pearl as much as it was like, this is my opportunity for me to hurt one of these things and get a little bit of my revenge back. Because physically, she can't match with the vampire. She can't do anything.
Yeah.
She doesn't even get a chance to shoot the gun that Blade gives her. Mm-hmm. So she finally gets this opportunity, and I think she's just like, oh, she wants to hammer it home and really fry this thing that can't really do it, get up and do anything. So, yeah, it's sadistic. It is torture. But I think to her, she needed that in that moment. And you could tell it in her eyes when Wesley Snipes or Blade walks back, and he's looking at her like, what are you doing? She's like – he moved, and she kind of snaps out of it for a second. But I was just putting myself in her shoes and saying, yeah, I completely get it. I'd have fried a hole right through that donut.
Another thing I want to say is when she learns that she becomes a vampire, what I love about this movie is it's really just interested in forward momentum, forward motion. Right. We don't get it. Just she learns she is. They pick her up. They take like, it. Just this movie keeps moving forward. And the expository dialogue is delivered when they are moving forward. It's right. rarely takes time for anything gratuitous. And that's why I like it. Just keeps going forward. And I like what you said about her. She just learns she's a vampire. She goes with it. He drops her off. She quickly learns what's going on. She teams back with him. It's just all forward momentum, and I dig it. All right,
so that's my number two. So if I have to do a secondary number two, and hopefully I'm not taking one off your list, is that opening shot, the first shot with Blade. Because I watched a video on the cinematography of Hannibal and how they break down a scene by shots and how on certain shots they're focusing all on him, right? They're focusing all on Hannibal, then they show Clarice, and she looks out of place. So the way they shot that scene, it's very up close. It's all these predators beating on him and moving in and moving in and moving in. And then they show him moving out towards Blade, and it's a wide shot of him. And instead of them being aggressive, they're halting their stance. And not only that, he moves forward, and when they move forward, they back up. I was like, man, that's brilliant. Just he doesn't have to say a word. It's just the way that it's shot. It's zooming in on this guy getting ready to die. And then all of a sudden, all you see is a pair of boots. And then they pan out. And then you see him. And you're like, whoa, he takes the power. He commands the screen. And then those confident steps forward, making everybody else back up and go, oh, God, what's about to happen? I just thought that was beautifully shot.
I'm looking at the GIF right now of it. I made one just for me. Just because it's such a great moment.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. All right. Yeah, I am watching that right now. That's so cool. All right, so I guess I'll jump to my, am I at number two? The scene where he just starts kicking the henchman and he just starts going 1, 2, 3, 4. And then he stops, flexes, like puts his arms down, flexes and yells and laughs. He's just, Blade is loving the chaos. Blade is just, he's just hammering him. He's too fast, too furious him. This is even Roman and Brian just
bitten Karen, correct?
Yeah. What's up?
This is after he's bitten Karen and has blood, actual human blood in the system.
Coursing through him. And he looks like he's running in place, just kicking a henchman. And then he just stops and flexes and laughs. It's beautiful. It shows personality. It shows how cool it is. Aside from Dark Knight, or, you know, a few other movies, show me something so cool. Show me
a movie that's not Punisher that shows brutality of a protagonist. You know what I mean? Just beating something for the sake of beating him.
Yeah, and he didn't have to deliver those kicks. It's so cool. I love it. I love it. All right, I think we're going to have the same number one.
I think maybe we will. I don't know. Number one for me, I don't want to get deep on you, but my father died when I was 16. So seeing him come home and seeing his father figure there beaten and dead, oof, and him seeing that and just him coping with that all in one motion, and then being the person that puts the gun in his hand and saying, okay, and then turning around and walking away as he shoots himself. That to me, I was like, oh man, that's powerful.
So good. It's well, I mean, you got Christofferson in there. That's another weird pick. Just bringing in Chris Christofferson. I love it. And just, oh man. And just, it's so, I'm telling you, Wesley Snipes, right? He's a very good actor. I love to, White Men Can't Jump. The blast that he had in Demolition Man. I mean, he also had, you know, like Major, I don't want to bring that up, but like, King of New York, Jungle Fever, New Jack City. He kind of moved into Passenger 57, Boiling Point, like Terminal Velocity, stuff like that.
U.S. Marshals.
Yeah, U.S. Marshals, that was okay, right? It's just, the dude could act. And in that scene, he acted. It was subtle, it was good, it was powerful, and it hit. Like, I was watching that too. I think I just stood there watching it. It was just so good. Oh, man. Yeah, great. My number one is the ice skate uphill, because...
How did I know that you were going to pick that?
I mean, some people, you know, some people are always trying to ice skate uphill. And that line is in the zeitgeist, dude. I'm in a movie bubble. Right. So maybe it's not.
No, it is. I, my best friend and I quote that exact line anytime we see somebody doing something kind of stupid.
I mean, it's so descriptive and random. And also, too, in these movies, it's just so random. Did he just say that? Did he just say ice? It's beautiful. Wesley Snipes said it. They included it in the script. And it's just so, once again, random and different. And it gives it so much personality. And it's weird that I keep comparing other movies to it, but I'm just talking about in reference to where this movie stands and in the genre. It's just, it's cool. It's weird. It's fun. It's just, I don't know. I dig it. I dig that moment. Same. And it just, it encapsulates what I love about Blade. And I know, I'm too defensive of it, this film, because of some of the lower ratings, but I dig it. And I think it should be considered, whenever big important lists come out about superhero movies, this should be in the conversation, because it's, superhero movies were around before it, and some of them had been successful. I mean, look at Batman, look at Superman. But in regards to Marvel, this was a big film, and it belongs in the conversation of important superhero films. It just, I just want people to remember that. That's all
it
is.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Well, this was fun, man. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Anytime. I love me some Blade.
I was strangely lucid today, as opposed to my other visits on your show, so I apologize.
It's okay.
So, hey, promote your show, man. Tell us more about it. Also, I think many people would know Robert Lamb from Movies, Films, and Flicks. He's done so many episodes. But also tell them about how much Seven Lamb's crushing it right now online.
Yes, we are absolutely crushing it here at Seven Lamb Productions. That's Robert and I put out a lot of audio dramas. It's like listening to a TV show if you're not familiar with it. But if you're listening to this, I assume you're probably pretty familiar with podcasts at this time. We have Atlas Avenue Beat, Paralyzed, End of All Hope, Tower 4, all these great shows that are absolutely killing it right now. And we are really approaching the 1 million download mark, which is absolutely huge for us. We couldn't be more happy. And we love having Mark on for anything that he'll come on for.
make it weird.
You're a part of that. So, I also do Alter Ego Podcast. It's myself, my wife, my friend Mark. We talk about all the pop culture movies and stuff that are coming out. We also do comics, character bios, video games. Please give us a check out. Like us on Instagram, Facebook, Alter Ego Podcast. It looks like a little Ninja Turtle with a band over it. So we really appreciate you coming over and checking us out, and you having me on as well, Mark.
Also, and to all my listeners in Romania, we're currently number one on iTunes or Apple Podcasts in Romania for film reviews. So all of our Romanian fans who got us to number one on the charts ahead of NPR for probably 2 days. But it's it's pretty cool. Number one in Romania. So thank you all for listening. That means a lot. And I got to tell you, man, like, I really appreciate you coming on and spending your time. I mean, you're a busy guy, and I appreciate everyone who listens, because there's about 7 million episodes of podcasts out there. And I just appreciate that you're spending the time on this. So thanks again for joining me, man.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'll come back anytime.
All right. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Jack Austin, a man who just is about ready to use some of his blood soap, which is going to be very, very gross. This is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.